The podcast you selected will start in just a moment after this important message from your humble host, Peter B. Collins. We made some changes at peterbcollins.com on Thursday night, the 15th of March. If you are a subscriber on a monthly basis, you should have received an email with instructions to close your account at PayPal and re-register at peterbcollins.com, opening a new PayPal order. If you are an annual subscriber, you should have received an email, too, that said you don't have to do anything. And if neither one of those applies to you, send me an email with your situational details. Send it to Peter at peterbcollins.com. We want to get it fixed up and get you fully connected as we move forward here and put those nasty glitches behind us. I want to thank you for your patience and thank our webmaster, John Gorenfeld, for his help.
Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. We continue our series about America's police state today, and we are joined by attorney John Eisenberg. John, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Thanks for having me.
And John has indulged me countless times in interviews in the past as I have followed this this case and this story for, I guess, 5 or 6 years now. And let's be clear for our listeners, you represent attorneys who worked for a now-defunct Oregon-based charity called Al Haramain.
That is correct. I think more accurately, they represented the charity.
Mm-hmm.
They were not employees. They were their lawyers, mm-hmm. among many others.
Okay. And this revolves around the illegal and now partially legalized wiretapping program of Americans in the United States that was launched by the Bush administration sometime after 9/11 and exposed by the New York Times in the fall of 2005. And you filed suit against First President Bush and his successor now, President Obama, to try to expose the wiretapping and seeking a ruling, I think, to declare it unconstitutional. Is that fundamentally correct?
That is fundamentally correct. We filed the lawsuit February of 2006, 6 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't so much to uncover the wiretapping. We knew that our clients were wiretapped. We filed suit to establish that the wiretapping was illegal, and not only illegal, but that the president didn't have the right to violate the law, which mm-hmm. was the real issue in the case.
Mm-hmm.
Does the president have power above Congress to do whatever he wants without regard to congressional legislation?
And the controlling statute at the time was the FISA law from 1976?
78. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, which was passed in reaction to the wiretapping abuses of the Nixon administration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And one of the critical elements here that helped propel this case initially, and it seems a little less significant now, is that, and I know you have to be careful in describing this, so from my point of view, what I understand is that the attorneys that you represent who worked for Al Haramain at some point came into possession of evidence that their clients had been wiretapped. And this, from what I can tell, was a document or a transcript or some other element that was inadvertently released to your clients by the FBI. And I know that you're circumscribed in what you can say, so give us your circumscribed description of that piece of evidence.
Okay, speaking very carefully and keeping in mind the Espionage Act, which precludes me from revealing classified information,
mm-hmm.
I'll say this. Al Haramain was being investigated by the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control for possible currency violations and tax fraud. They were suspected of funding terrorism. And Al Haramain got caught up in the various investigations post 9/11 into the financing of terrorist activity. During the course of an investigation by OFAC, Office of Foreign Assets Control, there was an exchange of documents from OFAC to Al Haramain's lawyers who were representing them opposing the potential terrorism designation, in which the government provided a bunch of documents that they claimed supported a determination that Al Haramain was funding terrorist activity. In a big, fat stack of documents that was given to Al Haramain's lawyers during this investigation, which consisted for the most part of pretty innocuous stuff, all public record, newspaper articles and the like.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of this big stack of documents was a document marked Top Secret Sensitive Compartmented Information, TSSCI, which is a highly, a very high classification for secret information that was accidentally put into this pile of otherwise public documents. And it was given to Al Haramain's lawyers and distributed widely among the legal team for the case and also to the clients, to a couple of directors of the program. We believe this document revealed unlawful wiretapping. And what I can't tell you is why we think that or what the document is or what's in it or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
All I can tell you is that after the New York Times revealed the existence of the Warrantless Wiretapping Program in December of 2005, we filed a lawsuit on behalf of Al Haramain and two of its lawyers for warrantless wiretapping of conversations between a director of Al Haramain and the two lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And with the complaint in the case filed in the district court in Oregon at the time, we submitted a copy of this document. And that's when things went a little crazy in our lives.
All right. Tell us what happened next.
Oh, what happened next? The first thing the government did is within a few weeks of, within a few weeks of us filing the complaint, that's a document that commences a lawsuit, along with the secret document in the case. Within a few weeks of that happening, the government informed us one afternoon that the FBI was on its way to the judge's chambers to take the secret document from the judge, to which we objected. The judge eventually held a hearing. I think it was about 3 days later. He held a hearing, and he said to the lawyer, to the government lawyer in the case, I understand you want me to give you the document. You claim it's the property of the executive branch, and I can't have it. But what if I tell you I won't give it to you? Then what? He asked the judge. The judge asked the attorney. And the attorney kind of hemmed and hawed, and I thought, my goodness, I wonder how he's going to answer that question. What happens when the FBI breaks into a judge's chambers and the judge holds onto the document and the FBI grabs it and pulls it from his hand? That would be kind of unusual.
Yeah.
An interesting separation of powers question, an interesting clash of the two branches of government. Well, fortunately, I think the government lawyers saw what was coming down the line and decided it was best avoided. He said, well, you know, basically, we're not going to try to take it from you. And eventually, we negotiated that the document would be held in a government facility called a SCIF, mm-hmm. Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. There's pretty much one in every major city in the U.S. There's one in San Francisco.
Sibel has been skiffed.
Oh, okay. I haven't.
I've been inside several skiffs. Well, you're lucky you're over there in San Francisco. Here in Washington, D.C. area, you're looking at maybe at least close to hundreds of SCIFs.
Yeah.
Even in each congressional building or each committee has also a SCIF.
And when I hear SCIF, I think of a Boston Whaler.
Well, wow, Washington is indeed the SCIF capital of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Out here in the provinces, we only have one that I know of.
One more reason for me to move, Peter.
Okay, so this very sensitive document that's the subject of this arm wrestling match gets secured in a SCIF. And I would suspect that as a diligent attorney, you might have squirreled away a copy somewhere else, maybe even outside the United States for safekeeping.
Absolutely not. That would be illegal.
Oh, it would.
If I were to do that, I would be in big, big trouble. I'm referring again to the Espionage Act of 1917, which says if you have classified information, you must immediately turn it over to the government. Somebody gives me a copy of a secret document, I must immediately contact somebody at the government and turn it over. Just holding on to it is a crime.
Hmm.
And while I believe in this case very much, I really don't want to go to prison for this case. I really don't. So no, in fact, I personally never had a copy of the document. There are a big team of lawyers in the case, and it was in possession of people at one time, but has not been in anyone's possession for a very long time because we just simply are not permitted to hold on to it.
And your recollection of that document that is stored in your own human brain, is that classified? And then, therefore, is your brain classified?
Well, it's sort of. Here's what happened. We filed the document. The judge said, I'm not giving it to the FBI. I'm going to hold it in the SCIF. Then we proceeded to argue for a number of years, literally years, over whether or not we, the attorneys in this case, could use that document to prove that our clients were wiretapped. Now, there's no doubt that the program was illegal. The problem with suing over it is you must prove you have standing. What standing means in the legal jargon is that you were a victim, your clients were a victim of the unlawful conduct of which you're complaining. So in order to get into court, or at least stay in court, we had to prove that our clients were wiretapped. And then eventually, if we could prove that, then we would litigate the ultimate issue in the case, which is whether or not the president could disregard the FISA law, could basically violate the law with impunity, which was President Bush's position.
And this standing issue is critical because in the case brought in Detroit before Judge Anna Diggs Taylor and many other cases that were consolidated before your court, Judge Walker, here in San Francisco, they were dismissed for lack of standing. And the simple issue was they could not affirmatively prove that they had actually been wiretapped.
That's correct. I mean, there were dozens of lawsuits filed over the warrantless wiretapping program and data mining activities conducted with the assistance of AT&T. Most of these cases had a real serious problem, which is that nobody could prove that they were actually wiretapped or that their data was actually mined. We could prove it with the document, but we had to be able to use the document to prove our standing, to litigate the case, to make our legal point, which is to prove President Nixon wrong. No, when the president does it, that does not mean it's legal. Okay? That's why we filed the lawsuit. But we had to prove our standing. And at that time, we thought the only way we could do it was with this secret document. So we fought for years over whether or not we could use this document to prove standing. The district judge, at the time the case was in Oregon, it later got moved to San Francisco before Von Walker. But at the time when it was in Oregon, the district judge said, the document is classified. You can't use it to prove standing, but I'm going to let you use your memories of the document to prove standing.
Mm.
So the government immediately appealed that decision. It went to the Ninth Circuit, and in 2007, now I find it so hard to believe it was that long ago. In 2007, the Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit, said that to allow us to use our memories of the document would be like using the document. It would be what the court called an end run around the state secrets privilege. So, no, you cannot use your memories of the documents for standing, which I took to mean that the part of my brain that remembers the contents of the document is classified.
So are all those sports statistics that you store in there too.
Well, I think they all got crowded out at some point by all the other lawyerly stuff I've been doing for 31 years.
Okay.
But that was the ruling of the Ninth Circuit in 2007. Your brain is classified to the extent that you remember what's in the document. You can't use it. But the court said, we're going to send this case back to Judge Walker for him to decide a really interesting issue, which is this. Provisions of FISA allow for litigating FISA violations under secure conditions so that you can use certain procedures in court, like private hearings, what they call in-camera hearings, not where the public isn't allowed, and various other devices to ensure that classified information that's used in the litigation doesn't become public. The question is whether or not those provisions in FISA displace or preempt the state secrets privilege. That's what the government was asserting in the case. A judge-created doctrine that says the courts will not permit litigation that requires the use of classified information that would threaten national security if it becomes public. So the question was whether or not this privilege that the government was invoking was preempted in FISA cases by provisions of FISA allowing for secure litigation under secure conditions. And the Ninth Circuit said, Judge Walker, we want you to decide that issue. So back we go to Walker. Now, what we're still talking about is whether or not we can use the secret document. We call it the sealed document because it was filed in the district court under seal. We're still arguing over whether or not we can use the sealed document to prove standing. And then we litigated that question for a couple more years. Shall I go on?
Well, I just want to talk about the state secrets privilege. I was the first recipient of the state secrets privilege order by Bush administration in 2002. October, that was when Department of Justice invoked the state secrets privilege. Now, not like the Espionage Act, it's state secrets privilege. You're looking at this, it's not even a law. It's based on common law, and it was never passed by Congress. So even the constitutionality of state secrets privilege is up there for question to be decided. And we know that up until Bush administration, it was really rarely used. You could actually count the number of cases where the executive branch invoked the state secrets privilege in one hand and still not use all your fingers.
Yes.
But then with Bush administration, they first invoked it in my case in 2002. And because they so easily got away with that, because the judges, the appellate courts, they all, without really examining, questioning it, they went by, you know, the government's assertion. They said, great, here we are. We have this fantastic tool, and we can just go ahead and invoke this privilege in all these cases that we don't want to see come up. And not for classification reasons, because in some of these cases, and I suspect in most of them, it will reveal our illegal actions. Because if you look at the state secrets privilege assertions since after 9/11, you see it in all these cases where the government's own illegal actions are being questioned, whether it is illegally detaining people or illegal surveillance of the Americans.
Or
in
torture.
This case,
torture or rendition elsewhere. It's the state secrets privilege is a lawsuit killer, is what it is. It's a way of getting the government out of court upon their assertion to the judge that if you litigate this case, the national security will be put at risk. And judges have been deferential in varying degrees to the government's assertion of the privilege.
Absolutely.
Some will just they find, whatever you say, executive, we believe you, and others will look pretty carefully at the assertion of the privilege. It kind of runs the gamut, and somehow it seems to have something to do with the political affiliation of the judge and who appointed that judge.
It's that, but it also is Congress, because after repeated abuse of the privilege, for a while, at least within the civil liberties communities, there were these talks and attempts to go and actually approach the Congress.
Oh, yeah.
Because Congress has a role in this also, but for some reason that was dropped. So rather than tackling this as a major disease, in fact, as something that is in contradiction of our Constitution, we, I mean, the activist communities, and I'm talking about everyone, ACLU, EFF, we keep dealing with the disease, not the disease, the causes of the disease, but the symptoms of the disease, case by case, because we are dealing with it in one case, and then 3 months later it's an NSA case, and then in 3 months later it's an AT&T case. So I don't understand why there is no resolve within the both the legal community and the civil liberties communities to really challenge this and tackle this once and for all and through Congress. Because as you said, in my case, for example, the government told the judge, we cannot even explain it to you in camera because it is so secret that we can't tell you why we are invoking.
Yep, it's very Kafkaesque. I'll tell you what happened to the efforts in Congress, and this is a sad story indeed. Toward the end of the Bush administration, when it became evident that Bush was invoking the privilege so often, there were efforts in both the House and the Senate to create legislation that would give judges more power to control the government's assertion of the privilege, to give the judiciary some real serious oversight in the matter. And a couple of bills were drafted, and they bounced around the House and the Senate for the last year or so of the Bush administration. And then we had a new president, Barack Obama. And what Barack Obama and his Attorney General Eric Holder did was they, instead of supporting the legislation that had been proposed in Congress, the Department of Justice drafted a set of new policies for internal policies. Don't have the force of law. They're just internal policies, which they promised they would follow to ensure that the state secrets privilege was not invoked as often and not invoked simply to hide governmental misconduct. And I believe what happened is they sent the message to Congress was, don't go anywhere with this stuff because I'll veto it. Right. We're taking care of it. We're putting policies in place. Everything's going to be okay. Don't worry. This president will not abuse the state secrets privilege. We don't need your legislation. And if you keep going down that road, it's going to end up being vetoed. And it died. This legislation died in Congress, and all we have now is President Obama's promise and the promise of his Justice Department that they will not abuse the privilege. Now, first of all, I think they continue to abuse the privilege, and secondly, even if they're doing a better job of it than the Bush administration, that's no guarantee as to what the next president's going to do.
Well, they have exceeded because they have invoked the state secrets privilege in more far more than Bush. Just during the first 3 years of Obama's administration, and there has been no indication, zero indication of anything improving, and that brings me actually to another question that you referred to when you were discussing the Espionage Act, and the question of classification, because truly, who's there to decide what is justifiably classified or not? And we haven't had that mechanism, even though cosmetically it looks like, you know, there is, because even their own review board for classification, and we have tens of millions of classified documents.
Oh, yeah, I think everyone agrees
and
that there's too much going on.
Correct, and even the government says over 64% of these are not actually, they shouldn't have been classified. So when we have something like this, and even executive orders, and this is the executive orders that says have not classified anything in order to cover up criminal activities or the abuse of taxpayer dollars, etc. Even despite that, I mean, there is no higher up. Who's out there? Who has the true authority to even say what is justifiably classified and what is not? And since that doesn't exist, and the government has a complete free hand to go and invoke state secrets privilege and just say, you know what, this is classified, then really, isn't this a police state practice?
Well, an odd thing happened in the Al-Haramain case, which is this. Eventually, Judge Walker ruled that FISA does, in fact, displace or preempt the state secrets privilege, and he was going to litigate the case under secure conditions. And he ordered the government to process me and two of my colleagues for TSSCI security clearance, which they did. Two of us were granted that security clearance, myself and my colleague Stephen Goldberg. And so the government said, you know, you can see this, you're eligible for this top secret clearance, but we're not going to let you see this stuff anyway because we think you don't have any need to know it. And Judge Walker said, well, yes, they do. I think as a matter of due process, they do have a need to know it. And the government says, you don't have any power to make that decision. Only we do. So, again, we're talking about some argument over the control of classified information. A federal judge decided that as a matter of constitutional due process, we needed to know the classified information that we were eligible to see. The government said, no, the judge can't decide that. We, the defendants in the case, have the power over that. We're not going to let you see it. That was pretty weird.
That's really arrogant, and I can't imagine a federal judge taking that. How did Von Walker respond?
Well, he never had to, because at that point in the litigation, we decided we no longer needed the secret document to prove our standing. Something like 4 years had gone by at that point. And so much about the warrantless wiretapping program, and our case in particular, had made its way into the public record that we, at that point, felt we could prove our standing, prove that we were, that our clients were wiretapped, without even using the document at all. So we told Judge Walker, forget the document, forget this issue. It's a tough one. We don't want to have any great clash of constitutional powers in this case. I mean, in a way, it'd be kind of fun, but
yeah,
that's not why we filed the thing.
Yeah.
I think we could be litigating that for the rest of our lives. And believe me, the courts are loath to provoke a clash with the executive, because you know who has the army and who doesn't. The executive has the army. They have all the power. The courts don't. The courts rely on the faith of the public and their credibility to have their exercise of power respected and honored. So we felt like we don't really want or need to provoke a clash of powers here. We just want to prove our case, prove our standing, and get to the real legal issues. So we told Walker, forget the document, we're going to move forward on unclassified evidence, and he said, fine,
now,
go for it.
Now, before we go to the next phase, I'd like to take a moment here and ask you to describe the true Kafkaesque chapters of this story, where you were asked to respond to arguments in a government brief that you were not permitted to see. So
well,
you were shooting in the dark, saying, well, if the government asserts this, my response would be this.
Yes, this was when the case was in the Ninth Circuit in 2007. And it wasn't so much that we were asked to respond, it was that we had the right to respond. So we're in the Ninth Circuit, we are litigating whether or not we can use a document. And we filed briefs in the case. And the government filed their own briefs, and we had no idea what was in some of the briefs the government filed. They filed some publicly available briefs and secret briefs. Secret brief in the Ninth Circuit. We're not allowed to see it. We have no idea what's in there, although we might guess. But under the rules of appellate procedure, we do have the right to file a response to the secret brief that we were not allowed to see. So we did. Okay, and it's so weird because we're allowed to go into a secret room. We're not allowed to take a pen or paper or anything that we could write down, that we could use to write down, you know, what we were doing in this room. we're allowed to go in there and use a government laptop computer under guard to write a brief, a secret brief, responding to a secret brief that we hadn't seen. So, you know, we kind of sat around and wondered, what might they say? What do we say in response? And then I went into this room and sat down at the government's computer and wrote a brief, answering a brief I'd never seen. And I walked out of that room without a copy of the brief that I'd written, I've never seen it again.
And were there any comments? Did Judge Walker ever say, hey, nice brief there?
No. Well, it was in the Ninth Circuit at the time.
Ah, okay.
And it was very odd because we knew we had to be very careful what we said in court and what we said in public documents and what we said in private documents, because if we slipped up, we could get in trouble. So it was just weird. Just very strange.
So are there any other aspects like that where you were operating in the dark, where the government was able to speak to the court, but you didn't know what they were saying and never would find out what those exchanges were?
Well, not that we know, but, I mean, how do I know whether or not the government has had secret hearings that I don't know about?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's happened in my case, but I know it's happened in others. There have been other national security cases that have been litigated to some extent in secret, and there have been secret court hearings, and you know, one side doesn't even know about it. I've heard of that happening. I doubt that it's happened in our case. Frankly, I don't think Walker would have tolerated it. I think it wouldn't have happened. But who knows? Maybe they litigate without him even knowing about it. I don't know.
We're talking with attorney John Eisenberg here on The Boiling Frogs about the wiretapping case called Al Haramain versus Obama. So fast forward a bit, John. At the end of March 2010, Judge Walker, who has since retired, and for our listeners outside of California, he is also the judge who wrote the decision overturning Proposition 8, which would have removed the right of same-sex couples to marry, which had been granted by the state Supreme Court here. And so he has a lot of controversial cases under his belt. So this decision by the judge granted you $2.5 million in attorney's fees, awarded $41,000 to two of the three plaintiffs. Tell us about this decision and how it was structured for the inevitable appeal process, which is now underway.
Well, it's complicated, as they say. The judge decided, based on unclassified evidence, public evidence, that our clients have been wiretapped. That was the easy part. We finally get past standing, and once we get past that, it's pretty easy because plainly the conduct was unlawful. So there's not a whole lot of litigating to be done there.
And let me just interrupt, because the way the judge found this on the public record was through a speech that was given by an FBI official. Isn't that right?
Oh, that was one of the key items of unclassified evidence in the case that was not found by the judge, but by myself one afternoon as I was going through the internet looking for various bits of public information that indicated that my clients had been wiretapped. And just literally through a Google search, I found the script of a speech given by the deputy director of the FBI to the American Bankers Association and the ABA, in which the director, his name is John Pistoli, the deputy director at the time, kind of casually admitted in this speech, well, yeah, we surveilled Al Haramain, of course. So we were able to use the FBI's own website to help to prove our client's standing.
That's bizarre.
It was pretty weird.
Yeah.
You can still find that posting on their website, which I'm kind of happy to see it's still there.
Very interesting. So go ahead. I'm sorry for the interruption.
No, I know you're looking for some of the odd stuff that happened in this case. That was one. Another one was when the FBI came out from Washington, or the DOJ rather, to destroy my laptop computer. I'd written some early on in the case, I'd used my laptop to write some classified filings, and the FBI wasn't happy about that, and they eventually smashed my laptop to smithereens, literally.
Mm. And you got to watch?
Yeah, in fact, they even let me keep the pieces. They're in my basement. Now, honestly, I've got pieces of my laptop in the basement that were destroyed by the Department of Justice because the laptop was became classified. Good mm-hmm. thing they didn't do that to my brain.
Yeah. maybe it was just a little brush back.
Maybe. So where was I? We're all the way up to 2010. We had forsaken use of the document.
Mm-hmm.
We had used public information to prove our case. We litigated before Walker the issue of FISA preemption and won on that issue. And he eventually ruled, I believe it was March 2010, he ruled that in our favor on the issue of liability, which was the big issue in the case. Did the president break the law? The president and his various executive agencies, the NSA, the FBI. And Walker said, yeah, he did. And all we have left to do now is decide what the remedy is. Now, FISA provides us with so many things in the U.S., in American culture, remedy means money. How much money do you get for the violation that was inflicted on you? And so that's ultimately what Walker had to decide. Now that I have determined that these people were wiretapped without a warrant, what's the remedy? How much money do I give them? And the statute provides for a minimum of $100 per day per violation. And so we calculated the number of days that our clients were wiretapped, multiplied it by 100, and came up with, per client, $20,400, was it? I think it was $20,400. Per client, three clients, our two lawyers and Al Haramain itself. Walker said, I'm going to give $20,000 to each of the two lawyers, Wendell Ballew and Asim Ghaffour, but I'm not going to give any money to the charity itself, Al Haramain, because of the way the FISA law is constructed, is put together, Al Haramain wouldn't be eligible for any of the money. So ultimately, the judgment is for $40,000. And how much did you say? How much, Peter? I forgot.
I have a figure here of about $41,000.
Yeah, something like that. I think it was $40,800 for the two lawyers, $20,400 each, mm-hmm. and none for Al Haramain. And that's it. That's 6 years of litigation for what? $40,000? Well, it's not about the money. It's about establishing the legal principle. However, FISA also provides for the winning party in FISA litigation to get attorney's fees. Keep in mind, I've been fighting the government for 6 years
mm-hmm.
at about 600 hours per year of my time. I've got more than 3,000 hours into this case. And so there's a matrix called the Laffey matrix after a case, L-A-F-F-E-Y.
Mm-hmm.
There's a grid for determining how much lawyers are going to be paid for work on litigation against the government where they're entitled to attorney's fees. And it all depends on geographical location and years in practice. And for me, for a lawyer like me in the San Francisco Bay Area, I've been a lawyer 32 years now, I think, 33, it's about $500 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So you multiply that by 3,000 and something hours, what's that add up to? I can't even do that.
About a million and a half.
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, I don't think I'm ever going to see any of this money, but that's how much Walker awarded to us. He awarded $1 million plus to me for my 6 years of work on the case and various amounts in the six figures to my various colleagues who'd worked on the case. That's how you came up with that number of 2.something million.
Mm-hmm.
That's the standard Laffey matrix determination of attorney's fees for the amount of work I did on a case like that and the amount of time I've been a lawyer. So does that mean that I can retire now? Not quite yet.
Yeah.
Because
it's been appealed again.
Yeah, it's been appealed again.
So
back in the Ninth Circuit.
And what I've read is that during the last week of 2011, the court issued a ruling which kind of split the baby. It said that the FISA reforms of August 2008 did, in fact, successfully immunize the telephone companies who were targets of the original suit, and it did not immunize the government. So since it appears that Judge Walker awarded your finding and awards on the basis of government wrongdoing. Does that mean you consider your case still very much alive and well, and how do you see the prospects now?
Well, it's very much alive and well. What you're talking about that happened a few months back was the Ninth Circuit decided two cases, and these involved the broader program of data mining that has been going on, where the government's been using unlawful means of obtaining information from, say, AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
The government, okay, Congress had given the government retroactive immunity for various wrongdoings that had been going on over the years. After the warrantless wiretapping program had been revealed by the New York Times, a bunch of lawsuits were filed against telecommunications carriers. Congress eventually gave them immunity from liability. In one of the decisions a few months back by the Ninth Circuit was that the provision of retroactive immunity to the telecommunication carriers was okay, was mm-hmm. not unconstitutional. So that was bad news for the various civil rights groups that were litigating these cases. The good news is that in the other one of these two cases, the government said litigation can go forward against, the court said litigation can go forward against the government. So you can't sue the telecoms now. They have immunity, but you continue to go forward with a lawsuit against the government, which is what my lawsuit is.
Mm-hmm.
So the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, is now able to go forward with their version of what my lawsuit is, only theirs is a bit different. It's a lot broader in scope. And they're a little bit behind me in timing, but it's the same general idea. And Sir Al Haramain is sort of brushing the weeds away at the vanguard, if I may, of a bunch of other litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So EFF is right behind us at this point.
And Cindy Cohn appeared with us in a recent podcast here at Boiling Frogs, and people can grab that at boilingfrogspost.com if you'd like to listen to it. So the current status then of the Al Haramain appeal?
The current status is this. The Al Haramain itself is out of the case. There's a judgment of $40,000 for the lawyers who got wiretapped,
mm-hmm.
$20,000 each. There's a judgment of $2.5 million for the lawyers representing the lawyers who got wiretapped. Now we get to litigate in the Ninth Circuit to see if we hold on to those judgments. Sometime in the spring, I'm presuming, the Ninth Circuit will hear oral argument on whether or not Judge Walker's decision should be affirmed or reversed. And I'm presuming sometime near the end of the year they'll decide the case. Now, it could be a lot longer or it could be shorter, but that's roughly the timing. What we're trying to do now is hold on to our win, and that means holding on to our judgment in favor of our clients, to our attorney's fees judgment, but most importantly, the determination by Judge Walker that no president has the power to disregard an act of Congress in the name of national security. That's why we filed the lawsuit. That's the judgment we got. We're trying to hold on to it.
And, John, talk here about precedent setting, because I'm not a lawyer, but as I understand it, by appealing it, if the case is affirmed, if Judge Walker's rulings are affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, that then sets a precedent that can be used in other cases. Am I correct, or does it have to go higher than the Ninth Circuit to set a precedent?
No, that is correct. The precedents are set by appellate court decisions. That would be the U.S. Supreme Court or any one of the circuit courts of appeal, the Ninth Circuit being the one that covers the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
A decision by Judge Walker, while it's published, does not have precedential effect, meaning it doesn't become the law beyond governing the rights and obligations of the actual litigants in the case. So if the government just had stopped, had not appealed Al Haramain, they wouldn't have any precedent that would govern conduct by others who weren't litigants in the case. They decided to appeal. They've been very, very aggressive about opposing us and opposing this lawsuit, and that was continued from Bush into Obama. Very aggressive.
And let me ask on that note, how would you characterize the difference between the attorneys you faced off against who were representing the Bush administration and those who currently represent the Obama administration. Better, worse, the same?
Well, literally the same, to the extent that it's the same people. All the same lawyers I was opposing under the Bush administration are the exact same people that I'm opposing now with the Obama administration. There's no change in personnel. The same individuals.
Any change in tactics or legal strategies?
No. None whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, I might say that the tone of the litigation has changed somewhat now that I'm up on appeal. Appellate lawyers tend to be nicer people. So I don't get in arguments quite so much with the appellate guys as I did with the trial guys, put it that way. But it's all the same people. So I expected there would be a fundamental change in how the Obama folks approached this litigation. On the eve of the inauguration, I thought this case is going to become really different now because we have Obama coming in to be president. And Obama is on public record as saying warrantless wiretapping is illegal. And so is Attorney General Holder. They were all very vocal opponents of the warrantless wiretapping program. And so I figured when we had a new president and a new attorney general, my life would get a lot easier. It didn't turn out that way at all. They have been absolutely no different than the Bush folks. In fact, it's the same characters, the same cast of players, with the exception that we have a different attorney general doing the same stuff.
Right. Some would even say that it is getting worse, and you are familiar with the latest on NDAA, correct?
Oh, yes. I mean, when I say it's all the same, I say in terms of my case, how it's being handled, no differently. In terms of the broader approach to national security that Obama has taken, it's been worse, really. I mean, he's done a lot more whistleblowing prosecution. He's defended extraordinary rendition.
Right.
There's this vast gulf between his rhetoric and his actions.
Now, John, you ended up having a firsthand experience with the system. You got a glimpse of this beast. A lot of people, a lot of Americans, many Americans, they just say, you know, these kinds of things may end up, you know, going after some terrorists or people who are really suspicious. These things, these awful stuff, they don't apply to us. You know, if you're ordinary Americans, we get up in the morning, we commute to work, we come back, we have 401k to worry about, we have kids to pick up from the daycare, and these things, they just are not applicable to us. So they're not alarmed. Now, some people are saying, well, we are moving towards the police state. And some of us have been saying that we are already there. I mean, when you look at it, you know, whether it's this NDAA or the illegal wiretapping of all Americans, you know, with the not only just your phones, but your emails and what you do with within the social networks on the net, and NDAA being applicable to all American citizens, and all the secrecy and all the classification and all the state secrets privilege, and with really nowhere else to go.
Well, you know, I think that anyone who says that all this stuff has nothing to do with the way normal people live their day-to-day lives, get on an airplane, or first go through security before you get on the airplane. Most of us fly these days. And most of us go through security, and that will pretty much tell you right then and there what life in a police state can be. I'm not saying that airport security is a police state, but it's definitely the government in control.
Well, you're guilty until you prove you're innocent.
It's the government in control, and they can pretty much do whatever they want with you. And if you walk through that machine and it glows green or whatever it's supposed to do. I was flying last week. I went through security. I got into one of those new machines where you lift your arms up. You know, I forget what it's called, the fancy new scanner. You lift your arms up, and you can see the outline of your body there. And I set the thing off. And they said, you got to come over here to this room. We're going to search you. And they did, and there was nothing there. There was some anomaly, the guy called it, an anomaly in my arm that set the machine off. And, you know, suddenly I felt like I got to do whatever this guy says because he's got power over me. And he can detain me. He can do whatever he needs to make sure in his mind that I'm not a security threat. And suddenly I'm in a situation where I have no power at all, and I must do as I am told by a government guy. And never mind whether or not the machine's malfunctioning, I'm a slave to that machine.
Well, you got the treatment that is known by the TSA guys as the full Chertoff.
Yeah. Now, I hope I'm not sounding a little paranoid here. I mean, I like machines as much as the next guy, but they kind of scare me when they malfunction. See, I know that I'm not carrying a gun or a knife or anything else. I know that I don't have anything at all in my pocket or my hand or anything. It's just my shirt. But suddenly I have to prove to the government that I don't.
That's right. And every time we fly, again, as Peter said, we are all guilty until proven innocent. Now, you know, we have had this national security government whistleblowers coalition organization for 6-7 years now. And you see the difference there. You know, with the corporate whistleblowers, it's really easy deal. They go to government, and in fact, when the government goes after the corporation and they win, they end up rewarding the whistleblowers. With government whistleblowers, basically, it comes down to this. You have nowhere to go. You know, it's like there is nothing above this government. This is the ultimate force. And granted, our founding fathers, they said, let's put some separations here in order for this not to be that ultimate despotism. And that separation, John, seems to us, Peter and I and the other irate minority, that separation has ceased to exist since 9/11.
Well, I think what the government is telling us is, if you haven't done anything wrong, you got nothing to worry about. Just be quiet, be passive, be cattle, and everything's going to be fine. And that's really not what the U.S. is supposed to be all about. We're supposed to be able to say and think whatever we want and not have to worry that if we say and think something unpopular, we're going to get in trouble. So that's what's frightening to me, just the notion that We're less and less free with each passing day.
And with that in mind, and this is my last question for this interview, John, you would answer it how? Are we moving towards a police state, or do you believe we are already there?
In some ways, we're already there, but we're certainly moving there. I feel that. I'm 58 years old. And I sort of feel like I don't have a lot of years left in the game here. If I were 20, I think I'd a lot more reason to be a lot more frightened as to what this country is going to be like in the next generation.
And, John, my final question for you is the recent unanimous twin decisions from the Supreme Court regarding GPS tracking. They said that a court order and probable cause are required. Does that give you encouragement that if the Al-Haramain case ultimately reaches the Supreme Court, that they will rule in favor of our Fourth Amendment constitutional rights?
Well, not exactly. It was a very narrow ruling, and it doesn't really say much about how they would deal with Al-Haramain. And I really don't know how they would deal with Al-Haramain. It's hard to say. Predicting what judges might do is a risky business. But it's just a nervous time period.
Well, John Eisenberg, thank you for fighting for our Fourth Amendment rights, and I hope you get paid eventually.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Give me absolute control over every living soul, and I'm sadly needed. That's an order. Take the warning tree.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.